I'm Chris Benda, Theological Librarian at Vanderbilt University's Divinity Library, and I'd like to welcome you to another in a series of conversations about recently published or forthcoming books by faculty in Vanderbilt University's Divinity School and Graduate Department of Religion. Today, I'll be talking with William Franke, whom we've had on the interview before. He is a professor of comparative literature, Italian, and religious studies at Vanderbilt, and we're going to be talking about his forthcoming book, Dante and the Sense of Transgression, The Trespass of the Sign. William, thanks again for being willing to be interviewed.
Yeah, thank you, Chris. Absolutely delighted to do it.
Great. Well, I just want to start off with a general question. How did you get interested in Dante in the first place?
Mm-hmm. Well, Dante is really at the confluence of the three main disciplines that I work in, namely philosophy, theology, and poetry. And I discovered this early on as a student, and then really just by chance, the encounters that one has. I was studying in England, I met an Italian, and ended up going to Italy and really adopting Italy for a long time as my second home, and learning Italian, living in Italian, Dante was then the inevitable choice, really, for my focus in working between these three disciplines, right, with his theological poem.
Hmm. Great. Now you've written about Dante before. You've written about the Divine Comedy, and you note in the preface to this new book that the approach that you took to the earlier canticles, the Inferno and the Purgatorio, didn't really seem to work with what you wanted to do with the Paradiso or with your reading of the Paradiso. Or with what the Paradiso demanded you to do. What was that earlier approach? What was the approach that you used on the earlier canticles, and why did Paradiso seem to demand a different approach?
Mm-hmm. Well, in a word, it's a hermeneutic approach.
Mm-hmm.
The first book, called Dante's Interpretive Journey, is a hermeneutic theory, that is a theory of interpretation that is worked out in and through a reading of the Divine Comedy. It's also then a critique of contemporary thinkers of interpretation, and especially Heidegger, Gadamer, and their hermeneutic school. It's the German hermeneutic school. It also includes figures like Schleiermacher, Diltai. That book was very much conceived within then a German context, and proposing a philosophy of interpretation which reaches a certain limit when we come to the Paradiso. Inferno and Purgatory are very much about interpreting all of history, the whole cosmos, in Dante's Christian theological perspective. But when he gets to Paradiso, he's up against the unsayable, the ultimate experience of God, the visio Dei, which Dante is aiming at, following the whole tradition of medieval mystics. That proves to be recalcitrant, right? Intractable to interpretation and to language per se as the primary instrument of interpretation. The whole of the Paradiso, from beginning to end, is framed within what we can call the ineffability topos. Dante is constantly up against what cannot be said. His experience is, by its very nature, and in essence, beyond the range of language and of interpretation. Right? And the first book actually is about the Divine Comedy as a whole. It simply turns out that the readings, the detailed readings, are all drawn from the first two canticles, as you say, from Inferno and Purgatorio. Paradiso, it was definitely part of the first book, and yet I realized afterwards why it wasn't given really the direct attention that it needed. One needs another theoretical paradigm. For that, then, I had to move from German hermeneutic thinking into French thinking of difference, right? This is maybe the deconstructive school. Figures like Derrida, Blanchot, Levinas, Bataille are some of the leaders here. There are, of course, numbers of others as well. But they are thinking much more about the limits of interpretation. And that proved to really be then consonant with Dante's experience in Paradiso. So overall, I'm trying to bring Dante into our contemporary context to let the Divine Comedy really speak to interrogate our context, our horizon, to use Dante really to get some sort of an angle on our own philosophical and religious questions today. And there did have to be, I think, this shift of paradigms in order then to go the last leg of Dante's journey to paradise, to the ultimate vision of God.
Since you've sort of gestured in the direction of well, you've talked about the ineffable, so that leads me to a question about your use of apophatic theology, negative theology. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what apophatic theology is and why. I presume you were I know that you were interested in it before you wrote this book. I mean, you've done work in that as well. So if you could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. Even though, just on the last point that you make, you know, the chronology of my books is not necessarily the chronology of my thinking. In fact, all of my books, in a certain sense, are simultaneous. That is the idea. You know, it's like what Heidegger says, that, you know, a philosopher has an idea, really just one. And he works on that, you know, all his life. The Dante is really what led me to apophatic theology, right? You know, after it was this work on Dante, which was really my, you know, already my doctoral dissertation, that led me in the direction of an apophatic theology, which the word simply means negation in Greek, apophasis. And the fundamental idea is that all we know of God is what he is not. We have no positive understanding or concepts. It's the via negativa. You can say anything at all about divinity only through negations. Now, there's a lot more in apophatic theology than that. It's a matter, you know, it's a question of which direction we're going to go.
Well, I mean, which direction does Dante, or what does Dante take out of that, for, or what you see Dante doing in the Paradiso, for example?
Well, there is a whole program, I think, of enacting the mystical tradition, as I say, which is based on apophasis. The mystic has to relinquish dogmatic theology, positive affirmations about God, in order to enter into this experience in blindness. Typically, there's always the moment of blinding in the mystics, as in Dante. When I say the mystics, the primary tradition of reference here would be Dionysius the Areopagite, around the 6th century, in some ways the father of Christian negative theology. Of course, there's a long tradition in, you know, behind him as well, coming from Neoplatonist philosophers like Plotinus and Proclus and Damascius. It goes all the way back, if you like, I think even shamanism, the Pythagorean cult of silence, maybe even the Eleusinian mysteries, all turning in some ways around the experience of silence, sometimes a discipline of remaining silent for years. This is really the millenary, the immemorial matrix for the kind of mystical theology then that Dante takes in the form that is developed by Dionysius, passed on through Erugena. Moses Maimonides is fundamental. He's taken up in the tradition then later by Aquinas, by Albert the Great and Aquinas, and Meister Eckhart, who is almost an exact contemporary of Dante. And Dante is then reenacting their mystical journey to the ineffable in a poetic key. Mm-hmm. Right? He's translating theology, negative theology, into poetics or negative poetics, a poetics of the ineffable, which curiously makes him very much our contemporary.
Hmm.
If we look at all of the negative poetics that have had such an impact on contemporary culture, some of my favorites in this line are Paul Celan and Edmond Jabez.
Hmm. Now, there are many streams in this book, and we're not going to be able to cover all of them, but one of the obvious ones is the concept of transgression, which is part of the title of the book. How did that become a lens by which you read Dante? And what are you talking about when you're talking about transgression?
Mm-hmm. Well, as to how that became a lens, I would have to say that it was quite contingent, and it was simply by the invitation, really, to speak to a conference on Dante and transgression. That was the title of a conference in Finland. And I accepted that invitation with a certain misgiving because it was not a topic that grabbed me immediately. It's very topical. It's something that people, it's even a buzzword in criticism today, but it's not something that attracted me particularly. Nevertheless, when I did begin to address it, I found that I could bring all of the thinking about Paradiso in relation to contemporary French criticism under this rubric, because transgression is thought through in radical and original terms by thinkers like Bataille, Blanchot, Levinas. The thrust of their thinking really can be understood as a reconceptualizing of transgression, and I would say of Dante's thinking as well in the Paradiso, and it's really that convergence that then began to attract me. And it's crucial, I think, to hear transgression in not just the ordinary sense of the word as some kind of disobedience to a law, some kind of violation of a certain code or order of things. That kind of transgression is very easily recuperated, and the transgressors are punished in the name of the law. That ends up actually reaffirming the system that was violated and rebelled against. The kind of transgression in question here in contemporary French thinking, and again I assert in Dante's mystical poetic journey, is not a transgression against a certain order, but against order per se. Transgredior, stepping over, stepping beyond, has to be understood as stepping beyond order per se, into a beyond, a mystic beyond, or into the outside, if you might have prejudice against mystical discourse. And it's a term like every term that I too would draw some limits to. It has to be critiqued, as does every other term that we can use, and eventually discarded in order to move us into the space beyond the order of language. and of law and of anything that can be defined, because all of those definitions are exclusions. They work by a binary logic. And the ultimate experience of contestation, to use what in many ways is an equivalent term in this French criticism, or transgression, or the mystic experience, the experience of the ineffable, is actually to step outside of these exclusionary orders and to try and live and act from a basis that cannot be circumscribed within any articulable order of things, but which remains responsible to what's outside that order and any order whatsoever, to really be responsive to the whole, to all, and to the not all as well. That's an important vocabulary, for example, in Lacan, le patou. I really would develop that mainly out of Rosenzweig, das Nicht-Alle. But that too is part of the all, right? The negation, what's relating us to what we're not able to conceive, what is beyond the scope of our language and our comprehension. That's essential too. That's where we actually open up to contact with, you could call it God. Whatever you call it is inadequate. It's the other as well, obviously. Another vocabulary that is, of course, developed with great intensity by these French thinkers of difference. It too has its limits, right? The other has to also be the not other. This is a point that's made brilliantly by Nicolas of Cusa, a little bit later than Dante, but working out of this same tradition of negative theology in his treatise De li non aliud, right, on the not other. Your other is only, again, your figment until it opens to the not other as well, and then you can react. And of course, you don't have any rules, you have no grasp, but you are broken open, and you're thinking, working, acting from some different basis that requires a responsibility without limits, without exclusions. Ultimately, now, of course, we're all living in finite bodies in a world that has all kinds of pragmatic demands that are made on us, and we do make distinctions, we do make exclusions, but we can also relativize them and then leave them open to revision, to reevaluate the exclusions. I'm thinking, for example, of a criminal who transgresses the order of things and ends up excluded. But that's coming out of something that we share in common with the criminal. We have to try to relate back to that common ground. If it's a ground, it's maybe an unground. I can't conceive it in any terms. This is really the idea of the neuter, to use Blanchot's favorite vocabulary, the neuter, the not both this and that. It's it's neither nor. I think that this is the inspiration, the motivation for the thinking of transgression, and even the praxis of transgression that we can find in a work like the Divine Comedy, like the Paradiso in particular, stepping beyond all orders of conceptualization. And I think that the contemporary French criticism is helping us really to try and go down this via, I won't even say via negativa, this via that we don't have any control over. And that's why it's open to risk, another famous theme of the contemporary critics, but also of Dante. It's his journey of ultimate risk, and it entails a complete loss of control, loss of self, in order to flow into a real community with others. It's, you know, this is being thought of most recently, I would suggest, maybe in even a later generation of thinkers of difference, Jean-Luc Nancy. There's a thought of the common. And the common really etymologically should be heard as coming from the word munus, for gift. It's co-gifted. We're co-gifted. And, you know, co-munus, I think, is a good guide. That word can serve as some sort of an orientation in trying to act from a sense of unlimited belonging of all to all. So that is what's really behind the idea of transgression as I'm trying to unpack it.
I want to ask you a little bit more about Blanchot in particular, since you do use his work, but it occurs to me in listening to you to ask a question, which I'm not sure that you talk about in your book, but it sort of springs out of what you're saying. In some traditions, religious traditions, you were talking earlier about order and moving beyond order. Well, and again, we're getting into the binary opposition, the opposition of order and chaos. Is chaos, or the concept of chaos, could it be part of your thinking about the beyond, or are we by thinking about it, are we just stuck in this sort of binary?
That's sort of what I thought I might answer is, you know, if you want to then conceptualize chaos, and that seems like maybe we're getting a handle on what opens up beyond order, well, that's another conceptuality, and it will certainly be useful in certain contexts and relations. But ultimately, the idea is really to open oneself beyond conceptuality. And you do that by working through various conceptualities, including that of chaos. It's not as if there is an alternative that we can take up. It's really calling into question, in a spirit of unlimited self-critique, the limits of our thinking within any paradigm, within any order of thought, right, ordered to any concept that we have. That's really the moment when our thought does break open, explodes in some sense. It can't maybe remain simply thought. It has to become something else besides mere thought. Maybe it even has to enter into passion. And perhaps even the passion of Christ could be exemplary of what happens to the Logos when it follows its own deepest impulses without limit to the end. You know, I think that's the challenge that the Paradiso is presenting to us. And there's not very much really about Christ, specifically in the Paradiso. It's not so much a theme. It might be because the very process that Dante goes through in the Paradiso is itself the passion. He doesn't represent it. We don't get the passion narrative, except that his own narrative is itself the enactment of the passion.
If we could turn to talking a little bit about Blanchot, since not everybody who's listening may be that familiar with his thinking. Who was he, and you know, what approach did he take? You focus a lot on language and on writing, as Blanchot does in understanding the Paradiso. So what approach? How would you describe his approach, and how does what you've already gestured in this direction? But if you could talk a little bit more about how this approach resonates with what you find in the Paradiso.
Well, as to the first question, there's not much to say, really. Who was Blanchot? The very name actually means something like white or blank, right? Blanchot.
So he was sort of inevitably sent on the route of doing what he did.
Yes, yes. He avoided, you know, scrupulously any kind of public exposure. He really wanted to be nothing but the author of the books that bear that name, Blanchot. He doesn't give us a public image, all right? And that is, I think, it says a lot about his thinking and his writing. It is writing, actually. Essentially writing, which for him is transgression. In some ways, he thinks that language itself is the annihilation of the real. In some ways, there is a polemic against language in all of Blanchot's writing. The name is, in some ways, a lie, because it presents a unity. You know, there's a name for you, and that seems to gather you into some sort of an artificial but actually quite false unity, because you are much more, and the contradictions. So there's, it's a language, in some ways against language, like Dante's writing, the ineffable, and therefore against everything that he has written. This is probably the compelling connection, that Dante, in writing about the ineffable, presents us fundamentally a work of language. And in fact, paradise in the Paradiso is nothing but the poem, this linguistic construct. There is no object, really. That is dissolved by the very nature of the poem itself. There are a lot of very specific and fascinating ways in which that happens. The deconstruction of the sign is, of course, one of the themes, even in the subtitle of the book, right? Il trapassar del segno is the phrase from the 26th canto of the Paradiso, the trespass of the sign. This is a phrase that even some of the listeners might recognize as the title of a very famous book by Kevin Hart. It's now the subtitle of my book, which brings it back to its original context in Dante's Paradiso. Those words are on the lips of Adam. That was his sin. It was the trespass of the sign. And Dante's whole poem is a trespass of the sign. It is a violation of the normal order of language, of the rules of grammar, syntax, semantics. It's all thrown up into the air. Language is reinvented as a neologism. That's what's really fascinating to study, is the specific neologisms. They're all over, but there are certain ones that, if I would really have to put them, I think, on the board and show you what's happening with these reflexive pronouns, becoming verbs, and it's crazy. Maybe one phrase that I could give you: se io m'intuassi come tu t'inmi, if I were to inmiify myself as you inuify yourself, right? That's a literal translation of what Dante has written in that phrase in an exchange with one of the souls that he encounters in Paradiso. That's the sort of violation, really, of any kind of grammatical norm that runs all throughout the Paradiso. Blanchot's writing is not like that, really, even though he too is aiming at the subversion of the order of language. One of the paradoxes, again, is that to try and in some way reach or evoke the beyond of language, one has to do it through language, or at least these authors, the way of Blanchot, like the way of Dante, is a linguistic way. There are maybe other kinds of ways of silence, but here we're dealing with a linguistic mysticism. I will say that for Dante, maybe an anti-mysticism for Blanchot. So one of the paradoxes is that it's by focusing on language that one is able to open up this space beyond language of the ineffable. And that paradox really runs from beginning to end of the Paradiso. I would say the same for Blanchot's oeuvre. One of the figures that Blanchot gives us for, I would venture to say, really for his oeuvre as a whole, is the pas au-delà, the step not beyond, because the word pas is simply the negative particle in French, but also the common noun for step.
Hmm.
All right, so it works both ways, actually. The step beyond, le pas au-delà, is a step not beyond. That, you know, that phrase says both, mm-hmm. as contradictory as they are. It says both of those things at the very same time. So to step beyond language into the ineffable, we step not beyond language. It's by going into language and into the collapse imminent within language as an order undoing itself from within, opening to this untamable, unmasterable, wild, I won't say what, but it's where all of reality is open flowing. There are no stable essences. Everything is defined by something else. It flows into something else. The interconnectedness of everything with everything else, ad infinitum, and then even beyond what we could define as a universe, as the whole, because there is no end. It's always related to the not all as well. So, you open up, really, this transgressive communication across all boundaries of concept, every kind of order, whether it's linguistic or social or moral. As long as we're abiding by certain rules, and obviously we do have to do that as finite situated creatures, but we also have to be relating to what is beyond all of that, or our order, and it could be our theology, it could be our religion, will become an idol, a way of repressing others that are not within that order as we conceive it. No, that order has to be a self-subverting order. And this is what happens to language in the Paradiso. It becomes a self-subverting order. And it's what happens to language in Blanchot as well. So it's to open to that not other and to let everything be informed from that space outside. And that is the renewal and in some sense perhaps a redemption. Maybe, you know, that works for Dante in any case. Of course, it's a non-redemption as well, you know, like, you know, not stepping beyond. There's a strong ethos in Blanchot against otherworldliness, and you know, in Blanchot and in his cohorts there, you know, the others in this school. And, you know, they would reject, in most contexts at least, you know, talk of redemption. And the point that I would make is that, you know, it has to be redemption, perhaps without redemption in any way that we are accustomed to conceiving of it. Mm. It has to be a redemption that is really open to redetermination and to what is to us indeterminate. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, I don't want to hypostatize the indeterminate either. Okay, so that too has to be emptied out in order that we remain in touch with everything that is concretely given to us. But we deal with it no longer strictly within our conceptual grids. Mm. That, we've loosened our grip on that in order to let that change. The truth, the reality of anything is going to emerge from beyond whatever order and language we've placed it within.
Hmm. Yeah, this, what you've been saying actually points me to another question that I wanted to ask about, specifically about what you say about Dante and his relation to the political and religious world of his time. And you talk about Dante sort of transgressing against the, at some level, transgressing against the political and religious authorities in favor of this transcendent authority, he doesn't want to. You talk about how defining this transcendent authority is a complex thing. So that's one issue. Then there's the issue of the idea that he doesn't want to leave things at the level of the transcendent. He believes that this transcendent authority should in some way be incarnated in the mundane world. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about the what's going on there? I think you also tie that in a little bit with, or to a degree with the French thinkers that you're talking about and their their conceptions about the mundane, the transcendent, what is beyond.
Yeah, because it's been pretty much characteristic of contemporary radical thinkers, the French and others, to be suspicious of transcendence, to reject it outright in many cases. The problem with that is, of course, it's binary once again. And somebody like Blanchot ultimately would not want to reject transcendence, because that is another exclusion. It's oppositional in nature. But certainly the transcendence that we might still want to envisage has to be one that is not in any way opposed to immanence. This is perhaps the point of Dante's word, one of his neologisms in the very first canto of the poem, transhumanar, to transhumanize. That's a kind of transcendence that is conceived from the immanence of the human. It's the human taken beyond its limits, rather than the positing of transcendence as if that were something that could be grasped and defined in and of itself. It's only a relation, transcendence, like anything else that I can say or think of. It's a relation to something else. So we do have to come back to the mundane world, even though what that mundane world is not so easy to define. And in fact, every definition is going to be contestable and prove ultimately inadequate. And the objective would be to rediscover the mundus, the world, freed from the constraints that we've placed on it by whatever order it is that we've been working within. And of course, we inevitably work within a certain order. The question is, can we also open up to communication with other possibilities, that order which we are presupposing in our thinking? If that can remain perpetually open to revision, and if it can come to me from the other, from my dialogue with the other culture, the other religion, we're not going to know the Christian religion except through discussion with Islam and polytheistic religion and atheism as well. There, you know, if God is what he's supposed to be in any, it's certainly in monotheisms, but I think in some sense in any religion and perhaps in any philosophy that really wants to be a love of wisdom and wants to think beyond any arbitrary limits that would be purely subjective and, you know, not have really the validity of a philosophical claim or thought that you can try and convince someone else of, then, you know, this God or concept is one that is going to have to be achieved, obtained through dialogue with others, and it's in between all of the different concepts that can be brought up from one side or the other. Mm. Now, there's more to your question that I think I haven't really come to at all. The question of Dante's conception of an order of the world, he does have actually quite a definite idea of the order for the world. And you know, I'm not denying that. Mm-hmm. It's so obvious. But my point is that in Paradiso, he does place any possible articulation of that world order into question. His world order is a monarchical order, actually. World empire is his prescription for peace. We have to have one order for the whole world. Otherwise, we're going to have factions and conflict and war. It's a secular order for Dante. He would not propose a theocracy, actually. It is a secular order. It's governed by reason and critique, I would suggest, even though it's, you know, of course, he has an authoritarian conception of the emperor and all. Nevertheless, it's all really placed within brackets by the role that unsayability takes on in the ultimate stage of Dante's journey. And the secular order that Dante imagines, which has to be independent. See, Dante is actually a pioneer of modernity, inasmuch as he separates between the spiritual order and the secular, and the secular order has to be granted autonomy. It can't be governed by the Pope. You know, that's what's really set history awry, is the popes became temporal authorities competing with the other princes, and that is, you know, had torn Italy and Europe really to pieces in Dante's time. So he does envisage an autonomous sphere for the secular, and as I say, it's there is already in Dante. There's the kernel, a budding kind of critical thinking, because negative theology is fundamentally nothing but critical thinking. It is limitless criticism. This is the way it's been defined even by scholars of negative theology, of the Neoplatonists, that phrase. Well, Hilary Armstrong uses that, limitless criticism. He borrows it from Jean Trouillard, who was a French scholar of Neoplatonism. So there is already the beginning of a critical, rational world order. And yet, that is not the whole, because it is within the context of a higher order, a spiritual order. So what happens in modernity is that the secular becomes God. That's really the problem. It doesn't remain open to something else beyond itself. And that's where, you know, I would say that Dante's model has something to recommend itself, really, even for our world today. That if we can take the secular order that Dante really bequeaths to modern thinkers, you could really trace this lineage. If we can take that secular order and not absolutize it, to leave it still, nevertheless, beholden to something else beyond, to a spiritual order that ultimately cannot be defined, articulated, and yet one, you know, all one's secular systems, they have to be responsible to that all beyond themselves, then the secular would not become vicious, a vicious circle closed on itself in some of the ways that we see and that are really inevitable, I think, if one doesn't have this negative critical capability. I say negative theological. One might say, well, why bring God into this?
But yeah, right. That was one. Why Dante rather than Blanchot?
Yes.
Or they...
I'm not choosing between them. Yeah. No. They, you know, they complement each other. But, you know, some of... I think we need both, really. Because the danger of Blanchot, or, you know, trying to take... you know, radical, modern, secular thinking on its own is that it's going to exclude each other. It's going to become oppressive. By combating theology, it actually, you know, assumes the same authoritarian role. Now, Blanchot is dead set against that. He maintains an infinite conversation with theology, even though theology is, in many instances, really his primary antagonist. He needs that in order to articulate what, to my mind, is a negative theology. Of course, he doesn't want to identify it with the tradition of negative theology. One point that's crucial that I didn't make at the beginning: negative theology does not exist. If it exists, then, you know, it's become another positive theology, right? It has to be this open space. Derrida does actually make this point about negative theology. Is there a negative theology? Seulement une, he asks, is there only one? So, to the question, why are we talking about theology? You know, why not just leave God out of this altogether? And certainly we can do that. In fact, we must do that to the extent that any words, any concepts are disposable. We have to give up the idea of God at some point as well, but it's maybe the best idea that we should hang on to in order to give up in some ways. Historically, the thinking of limitless criticism, if you want to put it that way, has developed out of theological matrices. Theology, and, you know, beginning with myths, even just, you know, primitive creation myths in primordial cultures. The idea of divinity of some kind seems, you know, very widespread, if not absolutely universal. there's, I think, really a historical reason for trying to think apophaticism, trying to think negative thinking from the concept of God, or at least in dialogue with the tradition of negative theology. It transforms itself. It doesn't have to be blocked and, you know, in adherence to one certain history. It transcends that history. But it does remain a fundamental point of reference in Western intellectual history for trying to think beyond the inevitable closures of thinking itself. Theology has, and specifically negative theology, which I would try to show is really the real dynamic in theology and in monotheistic theologies all along, and in some, in another sense, even in polytheistic theologies, that there's always, you know, some margin, some limit where the experience of the divine comes in the relinquishment of whatever concept of the divine is operative.
Mm-hmm. I want to shift a little bit in these last few questions to, because in a way your book sort of shifts a little bit to an appendix, which is not an appendix in the sense of having nothing to do with what you've been saying, or very little to do with what you've been saying in the rest of the book. It's not just an add-on. I mean, it's central to what you do in the rest of the book. In this appendix, you talk about, you focus on another French thinker, Emmanuel Levinas, and you bring him into conversation with the Paradiso as well, but your focus becomes the issue of the ethical, of how we relate to the other, which in this conversation, of course, has come up a number of times. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about Levinas. Maybe we know more about him than we know about Blanchot. What is his conception of the other as the origin of the ethical? Mm-hmm. And one question that came to me, and that you address, I think, too, in your appendix, is the issue of the other as neighbor and the other as God. Mm-hmm. And one question I had is there a difference between those conceptions of the other, or is there sort of fundamentally some sort of overlap?
Well, to start with that,
there's
obviously a difference in conception, and it's a difference that will ultimately not make a difference if we transcend the limits of the concept of the neighbor and the concept of God. Then we are in contact with some otherness that actually is essential to both. That sounds like we're going into a vague space of indeterminateness, and I don't want it to work that way. I would say that we come close to the concrete person that I live with or next to, that I deal with in my daily life, but perhaps without knowing what it is to be a neighbor, with the open question of, God, what it is to be God. I might think I know what the neighbor is. I know I don't know what or who God is. And maybe if those two questions, open in this direction of the indeterminacy in back of both of them, they can inform each other. Mm-hmm. So that now, in dealing with God, I'm not just in an empty space of I don't know what, but I realize that it's in dealing with my neighbors. And, this is an idea that you find in Christian scripture, right? If you say you love God, but you hate your brother, you are a liar, right? Says St. John, you would find it in other traditions as well. It's a very Jewish sentiment, I think, that is expressed there. There is a nuance of difference, and that's crucial. Nuance is another topic, actually, that comes up in the book. But Levinas does want, generally, certainly in his philosophical writings, to keep the focus on the ethical relation to the, well, he says l'autrui, the other, and one doesn't really know whether that's supposed to be the other human person or perhaps divinity in the sense of an absolute otherness to humanity. And in at some point it has to be both, and you it can't be confined, I think, to one or the other. You have to discover a dimension of infinity, of absoluteness in that other person with whom you are face to face, because there is then a human face that you're confronted with, and the demands of life and need. There's a lot of need that we're faced with in the other, in Levinas as well. The ethical relation that entails is one that is recalcitrant to our grasp and mastery. We can't adequately conceptualize it. It's there even before we have concepts, even before before we're constituted as a self. We're already in relation to the other. It's not as if I could constitute myself and then I ask myself, what are my ethical obligations? What do I owe to this person and that person? Levinas is placing the ethical relation prior to the very ontological constitution of self and other, and therefore of any kind of action. It's only in relation to the other and in responsibility to the other that I emerge. So ethics becomes first philosophy. You don't have an ontology and an epistemology before you have an ethics. There's no way of even asking the question, how do I know what I know in epistemology, or what is in ontology, before you confront the ethical exigency, the ethical demand of being there for the other, right? That comes first in Levinas. And I think that it does in the Paradiso as well, that there is this ethical exigency which emerges as prior to everything else. I suppose the emphasis is the relationship to God, but there is no relationship to God that abstracts from relationship with others in a Christian framework and in Dante's presentation in the Paradiso. It does have that an angle of approach that I think is different from Levinas. But once again, that ethical relation turns out to be prior. Dante's not presenting this whole vision of the cosmos and history as simply a beautiful aesthetic picture. It is a claim upon us with the most serious moral implications and demands. Right, that comes first before contemplating the beauty of the universe. However, neither should those two moments be separated. And this is a complaint about Levinas, that he abstracts the ethical from its cosmological aesthetic context. We don't act as ethical beings in a vacuum. We are sensuously determined. Levinas knows that. He emphasizes it in so many ways. But there is a kind of subordination of the ethical and the cosmological. Dante really brings that back. This is welcome. You know, there are many Levinas scholars who feel a lack of cosmological aesthetic sensibility in, you know, this absolutization of ethics that is driven so hard by Levinas. Mm-hmm. And that can be a mistake as well. That will become an idol. It has to be in communication with its own others. So, you know, there's something that can go awry in absolutizing even the ethical.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I go all the way with Levinas, unlike many who find, no, this, you know, when you become a hostage to your own persecutor, the consequences, really, that Levinas draws out lucidly of his, you know, ethical imperative are horrifying, or, mm. you know, they are... They really do demand the impossible. I would say this, you know, more than I would of anything in the Sermon on the Mount, right, which is famous for being in some ways an impossible ethical ideal. And I really do follow Levinas and his logic to all of the really extreme consequences that he draws. And nevertheless, I do think that that's not the last word, that the ethical has to remain in conversation with its others as well. Mm. And I think that that does then meet the criticisms that have been made of Levinas.
A final question, which I hope connects in some way with with what we've been talking about. Does being ethical require transgression?
Okay. Yes, I would say that that is what I've been trying to say,
uh-huh.
right, in a lot of different ways throughout this conversation, that being ethical cannot be a matter of following rules.
Mm-hmm.
There has to be something more fundamental behind that, and the only way to reach to it is through what I'm calling transgression, which doesn't mean that you have to do violence in any way. In fact, all of the different orders that govern human affairs have a certain sphere in which they operate, until some breaking point of revolution, to regulate transactions among human beings in a more or less peaceful way. But all of them do have their limits, and this transgression that we've been talking about since the beginning, and mm-hmm. you know, one of your first questions then, is the stepping beyond any of the definable orders that we inevitably work within. That kind of transgression, I think, is actually necessary in order to be ethical. If the ethical is not itself to be someone's system, you know, what is the ethical? You could ask Levinas or anyone else to define that. And, they could give wonderful definitions, but as long as we're working within anyone's definitions, I think that there's inevitably going to be some margin of exclusion and some measure of injustice to someone somewhere. Whatever, you know, my culture, Levinas's, the definition is going to come from somewhere. And it's by transgressing that matrix, that framework, and only, I think, by transgressing that, will the ethics in question not become a system of oppression, but rather a way of meeting one another, our fellows. Now, you know, it's not just human beings. There are lots of other beings on this planet as well that also need to be taken into consideration. And there are certain ethics, and, you know, Judeo-Christian ethics is often faulted for its, you know, being humanistic, you know, humanocentric, anthropocentric. And we have to be able to place that framework as well into question in order for that ethic not to become exclusive, oppressive. So, you know, what it's driving at is something that is open universally to the all and the not all. So
in some sense, you know, you're saying not simply is ethics require transgression, but we need to transgress ethics in a way.
Yes, good point. I do like that way of putting it. Yes. Which is not being unethical.
Right, right. We're not calling on any of the listeners to be unethical.
No, I think that's exactly right. And it's, well, you know, the fulfillment of the law, right, was, as, you know, recommended in the Sermon on the Mount, you know, transgressing the law was done not in the name, really, of being unethical or unlawful, but rather of fulfilling the law. Because any law or any ethics, inasmuch as it is defined, articulated, a language, a code, a system, it has its exclusions, and it's actually going to become unethical, right? Because, you know, it's working within these binaries, which our thought and our language inevitably does. But we have to become aware of that, and we can't escape it. But we can try and avoid the consequences of being ourselves mastered by those binaries, because that sets us in opposition to someone else, to someone that's unethical. Take the ethics of the criminal. I mean, there's certain, you know, French literature has been... Jean Genet has actually explored the ethics of criminality. Anyone's ethics is likely to have exclusions, and, you know, is inevitably going to have exclusions to the extent that it can codify and articulate itself. And that's why we're really going to be together and in harmony only beyond our languages. We use those languages, we can dialogue, have them interact. That's what we're doing here at the university, especially. But that's with reference to some other kind of bond that always escapes the way in which I'm able to construe it or someone else. And that's why it's so difficult to keep into focus, right? It escapes all of our terms, and we forget it. And then we say, no, here's my ethics. I know what it is. I can define it. And there's a certain sense of assurance in that. But that's also really by losing touch with the transgressive space of the ineffable, or the space of literature, is the title that Blanchot gives that area in one of his books, L'espace littéraire. It's really that space of of literature that enables us to be one and also distinct, other, beyond our descriptions, definitions, either of our oneness or of our otherness. We have to be able, I think, to relate to each other from some kind of a commonality that's beyond anyone's grasp and language, right? So that we cultivate a sensibility for the unsayable and, you know, the discourse that has taught me to pay attention to this ungraspable, evasive, elusive dimension is especially the tradition of negative theology that I find realized in philosophy and in literature, in poetry, like Dante and like I mentioned Celan, who is treated by Blanchot, one of the poets of reference, together with poets like Mallarmé, Rimbaud, they figure very prominently in the space of literature, as Blanchot describes it. I think that he, like Dante, is a pioneer of this region of the unsayable. And, that's where I think we find, we have to tap into that in order to stay at peace with one another. Hölderlin says, where danger is, there, da ist die Rettung, and, that's another word for something like redemption. There is salvation. Where that danger is, the danger of letting go of the framework that gives us a sense of security, but ultimately that's insecurity for someone else outside of it. So we all have to be together in the insecurity of not having a framework of our own. It's really, I think, by learning to dwell in that insecurity that all can be, in some sense, I won't say secure, but not in conflict with one another.
Thank you, William, for this conversation.
Thank you, Chris.
It's been a heady one, I think.
Yeah, I know that.
Again, I've been talking with William Franke, professor of comparative literature, Italian, and religious studies, about his forthcoming book, Dante and the Sense of Transgression, The Trespass of the Sign, due out in December from Continuum in the series New Directions in Religion and Literature. If you have any comments about this conversation, just browse to the homepage of the Vanderbilt Divinity Library and click on the Contact Us link at the bottom of the page. We look forward to hearing from you, and thanks for listening.